From your world news headquarters on the World Wide Web, it's time for your daily dose of sanity. This is the Maria Heller Show. Maria Heller is a published author, founder of The Universal Wheel, a lifestyle and philosophy based on our interconnectedness to all living things, a Reiki master, and delivers the news with spiritual views. How many intuitive news decoders, animal rights activists, and vegetarian broadcasters are there? Just one. Maria. Maria has provided independent news for a smart audience for over 13 years now on The Maria Heller Show, available at maria.net.
M-E-R-I-A.net.
And now, here is your host, the mouth that roars, Maria Heller.
Good morning, world. Maria here, alive and kicking. Welcome to the Maria Heller Show. Today I have a special guest with me, and it was my listening audience that turned me on to him and his work, and I got to say thank you. I don't remember which one of you told me about him, but I'm glad you did. His name is Jeffrey Shayla. He is a very interesting man. He's a psychologist. He's a consultant on addiction and social policy in Silver Spring, Maryland. He got his bachelor's degree in human interaction and group dynamics from Antioch College in 1973. He got his master's and doctoral degree in 1993 at the Institute for Child Study Department of Human Development in Maryland. He's an adjunct professor of justice, law, and society at American University School of Public Affairs in Washington, D.C. He's also on the faculty teaching psychology at Johns Hopkins University. His list goes on and on. He's got some other books out besides the one we're going to talk about today, Drugs, Should We Legalize, Decriminalize, or Deregulate? And another one, Smoking, Who Has the Right? But today we're going to talk about a topic that may hit you hard, and you're going to take a look at it in an entirely different way by the end of this show. And the topic is addiction, and it's based on his latest book, Addiction is a Choice, which might seem quite odd to you right now. I guarantee you it won't by the end of the show. So let me say good morning to Jeffrey Shayla. Good morning, Jeffrey.
Good morning, Maria. Thanks for having me on your show.
Oh, thanks for doing the work you do. You know, there's so many people out there being misled and abused. Okay. I see it as abuse by the medical industrial complex, who tells them, you know, I'm sure you've heard the adage, you didn't cause it, you can't cure it, and you can't control it.
That's right.
And, you know, I'm a person who grew up believing in self-empowerment and not giving my power away.
Right.
And when you look at addiction, I don't think there's a better way of giving your power away.
Exactly. What ends up happening is that people are taught the exact opposite of what they should be learning. They're taught that they're helpless when, in fact, they have the power to quit, and they do that all the time. How does anybody stop using drugs or engage in any, quote, addictive activity? They all do it the same way. They make a decision. They've had enough.
Mm-hmm.
So there's no helplessness there. There's just brainwashing done by mostly therapists who believe in a particular theory called the disease model theory, and they make a lot of money on it.
All right.
They also are very much involved with the state, and I have real concerns about that, because the state then orders people into 12-step programs, which I believe should be free to people if they want to go to them. But when they're coerced into these programs, they're basically taught how to think about themselves in the world. And that's, I believe, the state has no business inside a person's head.
I have to agree. Well, they're also taught that they have no power.
Exactly.
You know, I've met a lot of people. Actually, I have a friend who she's been in AA for over 11 years. And she continually refers to herself, even though she hasn't had a drink in 11 years, as a recovering alcoholic. And I said, well, at what point are you recovered?
Exactly.
You know, they never seem to graduate. You know, they're always a recovering alcoholic, a recovering drug addict. And, you know, how does that make a person really feel about themselves? Like there's really something wrong with them.
Exactly. That's exactly right, Maria. They're taught that they can't control their own behavior. And yet, when they go back to drinking, they're blamed for that.
Right.
There are all kinds of double messages that people give, mainly to serve the interests of the treatment industry, under the guise of, quote, helping people. What we hear about is that people say AA and these disease model programs save people's lives, but we don't hear about how many people dropped out of the programs. You may hear that 5 or 10 people say that they owe their success to AA, but you don't hear about the 10,000 that said, no thanks, I don't want to have anything to do with it.
Exactly. Exactly.
And that's, you know, the number one way people quit smoking cigarettes.
Uh-huh. They just wake up one day and
they throw away the pack and that's it. They decide they've had enough.
Mm-hmm. Well, what do you say then, and how do you describe, because I know a lot of people will say, well, I have an addictive personality.
I say that's nonsense. You know, I ask them to explain, and usually when they start talking about an addictive personality, what they attribute their behavior to is some genetic factor or some physiological factor, or they had a rough time growing up, and there's always some helplessness that they attribute their behavior to. Mm-hmm. You know, we never hear about people who say, I did something heroic or virtuous because of my genes.
Right.
It's only when they do something bad that they couldn't control their behavior.
Right. Well, you know, I talked to a young man this week, and because his family has told him he's an alcoholic, and his dad was an alcoholic, he said, well, you know, I'm genetically predisposed to being an alcoholic. And, of course, your book was the first thing I recommended him read.
Well, the fact of the matter is, people have been misled about the genetic model for a long, long time. And the bottom line is that 80% of people whose biological fathers were heavy drinkers, and you know we have a problem right off the bat, and that is describing and defining what an alcoholic is, mm-hmm. because that varies from culture to culture, but 80% of the people whose biological fathers were heavy drinkers did not become heavy drinkers themselves. Only 1 out of 5 ends up becoming a heavy drinker. And there's no evidence that shows that a particular gene, or what's called an allele or mutation of a gene, made them drink.
Mm-hmm.
There's no evidence to show that. Even if you had this alleged gene that everybody's always searching for, that isn't the same thing as saying the gene made me do it.
Right. Well, you know, it's interesting because reading your book reminded me of so many other people that I've interviewed and talked about on different topics. But when it came to the genetic model, I remember speaking with Dr. John McDougall one day. And I said to him, you know, my mother had breast cancer, my aunt had breast cancer. Am I predisposed to breast cancer? Will I get it because they did? And he had a very excellent answer, Jeff. He
yeah.
said, do you live your mother's lifestyle?
Right.
And the truth of the matter is, no, I'm as opposite as my mother's lifestyle as possible in diet, exercise, and so many things. He said, then why would you get it?
That's an excellent point because, you know, there are many, many people who witnessed a parent as they were growing up make a mess of their lives through drugs and alcohol. And because of that experience, observing them be so self-destructive, they've made a concentrated effort and decision not to be like their parents.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
In a sense, their parents' drinking or drug use did affect them, but in the opposite direction.
Uh-huh.
They said, no way am I going to get involved in that kind of behavior.
Mm-hmm. Well, I can tell
you. All we hear about is you're doomed to become an alcoholic, and then that becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy.
Exactly. And in a way, it almost seems like people enjoy it, like it's a good excuse for them.
It is. That's exactly right. And we hear about that with famous people now, too, when they get caught, you know. They apologize, like Marion Barry, the mayor of D.C. years ago, and the first thing he did was say, you know, I have a disease and I shouldn't be punished for my disease.
Mm-hmm. Well, the rich and celebrities, they get to go to rehab. Uh-huh. Everybody else goes to prison.
Right. There you go.
You know, I mean, I had so many revelations and I wrote so many notes in your book, I feel like I co-authored it while I was reading it. But you know what's interesting is I just had a visit from a young couple that I love dearly. About 2 years ago, they really were out of control with their drinking. And just the business they're in, it's just, it's a normal part of it. Everybody wants to buy you drinks. And they ended up, you know, they knew they couldn't go to AA because they don't believe in giving their power away. Right. And they did some online course. I don't remember the name of it. And they stopped drinking, okay? They didn't stop totally. They moderated. They went from that to, you know, drinking O'Doul's, okay?
That's right.
And it saved them. It literally saved their marriage. So when they were talking with me this weekend, of course I brought out your book. And I said, you know, usually it's that somebody's life has a big hole in it. There's a misery somewhere in your life or a deal that you don't want to face. So you fill it either with alcohol, with drugs, you know, whatever, you know. And they understood that. And, you know, I really believe everybody needs this book. Okay. I mean, it wowed me. All right.
I'm glad to hear that. You know, Maria, you just put your finger on a very important point there, though. There's something going on in the person's life that they numb themselves to through drugs or shopping or any kind of activity that's a distraction from their problem. Mm-hmm. And what they're taught through most treatment programs is there is no psychosocial problem. There's a problem that comes from drinking, and that's what they've got to address, the drinking. And the point of view that I advocate is that there's something you don't want to look at in yourself, and so you drink to numb yourself to that. Now, what people also say is, well, you're just telling people they have a weak will. In fact, I'm saying the opposite. I say you have an iron will. You will drink or take drugs at the expense of your health, your family, your job. It doesn't have, weak wills don't have anything to do with it.
Mm-hmm.
It's the iron will. Well, you will just keep doing this, and no matter who you hurt, because primarily you're interested in your own narcissistic pleasures.
Right, just taking care of yourself. You know, it's interesting because last night I watched that movie Dallas Buying Club with Matthew McConaughey, and I hadn't seen it when it came out. And here you have people that know they have AIDS, and instead of dealing with the AIDS and you know, taking the cocktails and whatever that his character finds for them in Mexico, you still see a lot of them self-destructing, you know, doing cocaine, shooting up, all kinds of heavy drugs and this and that. And I could make the connection because I read your book. I understood, okay, they're filling a hole. And I want to thank you because somebody very close to me has had a severe drinking problem, self-destructive drinking problem, for about 5 years.
Right.
And that person was miserable. And I started reading your book, and probably about 3 months ago, something happened where he found the right job, he's in a place where he really wants to be, he's living where he wants to live. And suddenly he was only drinking on his one day off a couple of drinks. And I had asked him, I said, what changed? What made you get the ability to moderate your drinking? And he said he didn't know. So when I started reading your book, I called him and told him. I said, you're happy now. You filled that hole and you don't need it. And subsequently, he doesn't drink at all because he doesn't have time. He's happy.
And you know, Maria, that's the rule, not the exception. That's the way most people end up quitting. And everybody quits, again, the same way. They have to quit by making a decision. I mean, we can't just handcuff them all the time.
Right.
So they could never reach for a drink. You know, another thing, when you look at smoking programs, people say that people are addicted to cigarettes because of nicotine.
Mm-hmm.
That's the current thinking. But if that's true, then when we give people nicotine replacement therapy, that should work.
Right.
Right?
Right.
Only guess what? It doesn't work because it doesn't have to do primarily with nicotine.
Mm-hmm.
If you give them a nicotine patch or a pill, then
right,
why would they want to smoke cigarettes? They're getting all the nicotine and more through the pills. The bottom line is the smoking is a ritual, a ceremony that they find meaning in doing. That's
right,
the thing. Well, and that's going to be different for each person because no two people are identical. You know, people use drugs or alcohol or any activity in a self-destructive way for different reasons with different results. We can't treat all the people like they're the same. They aren't the same. But our treatment programs are based on the idea that addicts, which I don't even believe there is such a thing as an addict, are all the same, that they're a homogeneous population. And that's just not true.
Right. Well, you know, years ago, they considered homosexuality an addiction, a disease.
Right.
And there are still states that want to pass laws to keep this gay conversion therapy garbage going. I mean, what do you think about gay conversion therapy?
I think that it is a horribly destructive way of relating to people that they find scary. And it's the whole idea that, well, we had homosexuality declassified from the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders by the American Psychiatric Association in 1973. Did they discover that it wasn't a disease? No, it was a political process. That's how they declassified it, which is exactly how they classified it, for political reasons, not for scientific reasons.
Mm-hmm.
So this is a way of persecuting a group of people.
Right.
Telling them that they're sick and trying to change them as a result. It's part of a scapegoating process.
Well, and
why do we scapegoat people? Because we believe that evil comes from these different groups of people, and we can affirm our right way of living if we just make them adjust to how we think they should live.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, to me, that when I see that gay conversion therapy, which they still want to keep legal, I think, in Texas and Oklahoma, it smacks of Hitler to me, okay?
Exactly.
I mean, I don't know how people can't see that. I look at it, and if you want, listen, I've always believed, and, you know, I was always odd man out, even as a kid, Jeff. I always believed that people have the right to kill themselves if they want to.
There you go.
Okay, if you want to OD on drugs, that's your business. You know, it's not something the government should get involved in. And your chapter where you compare it, you know, on First Amendment rights, being forced basically to go for treatments by the government. You're either going to AA or you're going to jail.
Right.
Why shouldn't a person have control over their own body, whatever they want to do to it? It's their body.
Exactly. And that's what it boils down to. Whose property is their body? Is it their own property or does it belong to the government and other people? And this is what's happening in terms of what public health means more and more today. Now we're getting, you know, we're hearing that suicide is a public health problem. Crime is a public health problem. All the real reasons that we called things public health problems, where people caught diseases, you know, not by their own actions, those were the original meanings of public health. But now if you engage in high-risk behaviors, you're said to be unable to control your behavior, and therefore it's a public health reason matter, and on that basis the government intervenes.
Mm-hmm.
That's what we mean by the nanny state.
Right, so if you do any kind of behavior that's considered socially unacceptable, you're labeled as a disease.
That's exactly right.
I mean, this is
a
crazy world.
Really began back in the late 1700s with Benjamin Rush, one of the signers of the Declaration of Independence. And he was one of the first people to medicalize socially deviant behavior. Any type of behavior that he didn't approve of, he called a disease.
Mm-hmm.
He even said that Negro slaves had black skin because they had a genetic form of leprosy. He called nigritude. And it was funny because a black slave by the name of Henry Moss was brought to Benjamin Rush because he had white spots on his arm. And he said, you are experiencing the spontaneous cure of nigritude, your blackness. And what they really had was vitiligo.
Right.
Which is a disease that many people have, white and black, where you lose the pigmentation in your skin. But on this basis, he said, blacks and whites should not intermarry because this disease will be spread. So he used a fake medical invention to justify a racist policy.
crazy. Well, that's kind of like what Michael Jackson had.
It is. It is very much what he had.
Yeah, my own aunt had that. I mean, and she was Sicilian. You know, she had all those white spots all over her pink skin.
Exactly.
You know, she just kept losing the color in her body, and, you know, that there you go.
Right. That's right.
You make, I can't even tell you how excited I was reading your book. I said, oh, God, I love this. When you talk about addiction and you compare it to addiction to religion.
Right.
And that's pretty brave and bold. And I was thinking, reading your book, I said, wow, how much flack has this guy gotten for having such different views than most of the psychiatry business?
A lot of flack. A lot of flack. But, you know, that just lets me know that I'm on the right track.
Hey, I agree. That's how I feel about my show, too.
Exactly.
I'm sure we're going to get some flack today, but not from my audience.
Right, right.
But well, when
that's
you look,
how I got involved in this in the first place. Because I, years and years ago, I didn't realize that this controversy existed. And I was on an advisory council for the county on drug use, and somebody said, well, this is a disease. And I innocently said, no, it's not a disease. You're just saying that so that you can implement certain policies and get insurance reimbursement and all that.
Wow.
I was denounced all over the state of Maryland. And I was so interested in why I was being denounced. And so I did my whole doctoral dissertation on what it was that best explained why people held these views.
Mm-hmm.
And usually it had a lot to do with believing in some external force. And I don't want to be insulting towards anyone because I think people certainly have a right to believe in God. But the deeper their spiritual or religious thinking, the more inclined they were to believe that some external force governed their behavior. In other words, the devil made me do it.
Right, but you know, when you look at AA and a lot of these supposed treatment centers,
right,
they have their own language. You're really restricted. You can't talk out against it. You can't ask questions.
Right.
And you know, when I thought about that, and then I read in your book, you call that thought termination.
Right.
I thought about my religion that I was raised in, and you couldn't ask questions. You know, Catholics used to be told when my dad was young that you had no right to read the Bible and you couldn't read any other holy books.
Right.
And when you look at a lot of these treatments, just like religion, they are thought terminating. Why are they so afraid that people might think on their own?
Because it disrupts the unity of the group. And this is one of the ways I characterize cults. And I'm writing about this now in my current book. In a cult, any group can become a cult. It doesn't have to have a charismatic leader, in my opinion. All it has to do is forbid disagreement. And that's the way I've encouraged people to test the integrity of a group. To what extent will they allow you to challenge the beliefs that people have?
Mm-hmm.
Usually, when people start challenging the beliefs and disagree, and people come down on them, telling them that they're sick or they're bad,
mm-hmm.
and eventually they may kick them out, those are the characteristics of cult-like group behaviors.
Well, saying that then, would you compare AA and NA and all of that to a cult?
Absolutely. I've written on this extensively. Absolutely a cult.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Well, I have to agree. Listen,
my thing is, if you want to go there and engage in, again, what I consider foolish and irrational beliefs, by all means, go and do it.
Right.
I may try to persuade you about how that's a bad idea, but I don't think I have a right to coerce you into it or out of it.
Uh-huh.
And now what's happening is that people say that the state has a right to coerce people into these groups. It's the only way they think they can save persons' lives, which is nonsense.
Well, I don't believe they're interested in saving people's lives.
Exactly.
If that was the case, we would have a whole different food pyramid to start out
right.
with.
You know? That's right.
So that's just another myth that they try to tell people. I did want to ask you about our kids, okay, our children.
Right.
So
right.
many children today on drugs, legal drugs, okay, which I think are more dangerous than illegal drugs, but that's a topic for another day. And now I was reading an article where they want to even classify daydreaming as a disease.
Oh, it's just unreal. I mean, we have such double messages for kids. I mean, think about it. On the one hand, we tell them you should not take illegal drugs, for example, marijuana, that you want to take to change the way you feel and perceive the world, mm-hmm. right? You should not do that. But you should take drugs that we tell you to take to change the way you feel, and you don't want to take those drugs. I mean, we live in a drug society. I mean, look at almost everybody is on some type of drug. It's either prescription drug to change the way they feel or for genuine disease, but then there are the illegal drugs. Then there are the over-the-counter drugs. I mean, do you know how many people take Tylenol and Aleve and those drugs every day?
And all day long. I know people that take it all day long.
Right. I mean, drugs are us. You know, it's like Toys R Us, drugs are us.
Right. Well, you know, I had a report about a month ago that said out of all the world's pharmaceuticals, Americans eat 33% of them.
I believe that. Sure.
But what do you think about all these diseases with our kids? ADHD and, you know, daydreaming and all this. Has childhood become a disease?
Yes, it is. You know, one of the things I've noticed is when children are diagnosed with these I call them mythical diseases like ADD, ADHD, what we see is always the blame is put on the child and on his physiology. Mm-hmm. You don't see the teachers being blamed, the school systems being blamed, what's taught in school being blamed. Does it ever occur to them that kids are bored in school?
Right.
They don't get why they should be working on all this stuff, and that even if they work really, really hard, they aren't necessarily going to make it. There are other factors that are involved in becoming successful.
Well, you know,
I
agree.
Think a lot of kids feel like, what's the point?
I talk to kids. You know, my granddaughters are teenagers, and luckily one just graduated high school, and I went to her graduation, and I said, now your real education can begin.
Right.
But these kids were bored to tears. You know, they're learning math that I couldn't wrap my head around if I had to, and yet high schoolers can't even tell time on a non-digital watch or make change from a dollar, and this is what's graduating. And I agree with you, and that's why I loved your book so much. When I was a kid in school, remember, this was the 50s and 60s.
Yeah.
And, you know, all right, I don't want to brag, but obviously I must have been smarter than a lot of the other kids because I was bored to tears. And if I was bored to tears, imagine today when kids are so much sharper and so much quicker, how boring it must be for them.
Well, how many kids sit there and watch the clock? Can't wait for the day to be over. They mm-hmm. watch from minute to minute. They're just bored stiff.
Right, and if they ask anything, you know, untoward of the teacher, I guarantee you that I know, had all these drugs been around when I was going to school, they probably would have drugged me up to the max because I questioned everything, which is what a child should do.
Well, and diagnosis, whether it's with children or adults, has now become a weapon. It's a weapon to control people who exhibit behavior that's socially unacceptable. I mean, we never say to people, you cancer, you diabetes, you tumor. We say, you're a psychopath, you have a psychiatric disorder, you have all these things, because those are most closely related to being angry with somebody else. There's something wrong with you.
Right. Well, how many people are told they're bipolar? How many people will say they're bipolar and never really gotten diagnosed? And I'm not saying that these diseases may not exist. They might be true for maybe 1%.
Exactly.
But today, everybody wears their disease like it's a badge of honor. I have an excuse. I have ADHD. I'm bipolar. You know, I'm premenstrual. Everybody comes up with all kinds of stuff to defend themselves. Right.
And I don't think that people understand the price they pay by giving up responsibility. When they're told to give up responsibility, they pay a price mm-hmm. because other people are then responsible for them.
Right. Fix me.
You know, you pay a price in terms of your own freedom. Responsibility and freedom are positively correlated. The more responsible, the more free. The more free, the more responsible. Mm-hmm. If we tell you that you can't control yourself, then we are in charge of your life, and we
right.
take away your liberty.
Right, we take away your children.
In prison. In mm-hmm. prison, they're there. I know kids and people who don't mind going to prison because they basically get a free education.
Mm-hmm.
They get room and board. They know their place in the society if they're tough enough. And they don't have to work. All they have to do is give up their freedom.
Well, they also have boundaries put right. on them, which a lot of children exactly. today don't have. And when you look at all these school shootings going on, pretty much every one of these kids is on a psychotropic drug.
Right.
You know, antidepressants.
And as you know, there's a lot of concern about whether any of those drugs are acting as some kind of stimulus for them to go wild. To
well, all you
wild.
Have to do is look at the side effects. You know, the side
right.
effects of most antidepressants is suicide or homicidal
right.
thoughts.
That's exactly right.
So, you know, yesterday people were arguing, I guess, over the latest shooting, and, you know, they want to blame guns. And I said, you know, guns have been part of America since we started. So what changed? We got to look at the fact these kids are on drugs. They're eating food that's not really food. You know, I mean, they're just polluted. They got nothing to look forward to. They're antisocial thanks to their gadgets. They're always on gadgets. They're fed a diet of violence and double messages, you know, stay celibate, but everything they see is sex.
Right.
You got to say, what changed in the past 200 years? Everybody had guns. Kids used to walk down the street with them, you know, in the
right.
Wild West.
It's a new scapegoat. I agree with you completely. And what are the two things that people focus on? It's either the gun or the fact that people didn't get committed to a mental hospital before they committed the bad act.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there is such a thing as due process. We do have a Bill of Rights, and as far as I can tell, there's no postscript at the bottom that says P.S. for mentally healthy people only.
Mm-hmm. Right,
you know,
that's a good one.
If you get diagnosed with some kind of mental disorder, then they can commit you against your will
right.
and put you in a mental hospital and drug you.
Exactly.
And that, they believe, is going to keep them from committing acts of violence. Most people who are diagnosed with mental illness don't commit acts of violence. But, of course, the people that do commit acts of violence are immediately diagnosed with a mental disease.
Mm-hmm. Good point. Jeff, we're going to take a short break, but stay with us. When we get back, I've got a Lollapalooza of a question for you, Jeff.
Great.
So stay with us. We'll be right back. Okay, welcome back. My guest is Jeffrey Shaler, and we're talking about his book, Addiction is a Choice, which I believe is excellent. Everyone knows somebody who's convinced themselves they have a disease, and they need to hear and read this book. This is a keeper, one you're going to want to keep in your library. I know I won't even lend my copy out. Jeff, before the break, I said I had a lot of Lollapalooza question for you. I do kind of life coaching and counseling for people too. And I have this couple, both of them very highly sexed. The man believes that he's a sex addict, so he goes to sex addiction meetings, which are very similar to AA. The woman doesn't believe she has a sex addiction. She just believes she has a healthy sexual appetite. And, you know, back in my day, a man like that would have been considered a stud. But today, if you have sex more than twice a week, I guess you're a freak. Is sex addiction real?
By addiction, if by addiction you mean the person cannot control his or her behavior,
yes,
it is not real. It's a myth. And, everything that Masters and Johnson talked about was a bunch of nonsense. It's just amazing how they developed something sexually titillating and called it medical treatment for a medical disease. This was nonsense. And my good colleague, Thomas Zoss, psychiatrist who just died 2 years ago, wrote a book, Taking Them Apart, gene by gene, in his book, Sex by Prescription. Any, there is no such thing as an involuntary behavior. That's what it boils down to, Maria. So when people say to me, and students have said, is this a disease? Is this behavior a disease? I say, is it a behavior that you're talking about? And they said, yes. And I said, well, then is there such a thing as an involuntary behavior? Remember, we've talked about that.
Right.
And they said, I guess not, because there is no such thing as an involuntary behavior. What people call an involuntary behavior is a seizure. When you go to the doctor and you get a knee reflex, that's a reflex action. It's not a behavior. There's no volition involved. But how can you go and get sex, drinks, drugs, as if you're having a convulsion?
Right, unless
it makes any sense.
Right, unless of course.
Sense at all.
Unless of
course. If you were driving down the road and you had a seizure from a disease called epilepsy, and you killed someone, of course we wouldn't hold you responsible.
Right.
Because, you know, you couldn't do anything about that. Actually, what happens, though, is a judge would say, you've got epilepsy, now it's your responsibility to take your medicine if you want to drive. And if you don't take your medicine and have another seizure and harm somebody, now we're going to hold you to a higher standard of responsibility.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, we have to differentiate between seizures and voluntary behaviors, and there just is no such thing. I challenge anybody to tell me a behavior that is involuntary.
Right. Now,
this has serious implications for law and criminal responsibility.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's the other thing. No one wants to take responsibility. You know, yeah. Not from our top leaders all the way down to, you know, the bum on the street.
I don't know. I mean, I had a guy who came for counseling years ago, and he said that he thought he masturbated too much. And I said, what's too much?
Right.
I don't know. Is it twice a day too much? Is it 20 times? You know, it's a problem if it interferes with other aspects of your life.
Right.
But that doesn't make it a disease, and that also doesn't make it something you can't control.
No, and I would
assume you have an obligation as an adult to find a way to control your behavior.
Right. Well, you know, I would say at least he has a healthy prostate. You can always look at the good side of everything.
Exactly.
Look, I have a very good sense of humor. You have to do what I do. Is there a difference between addiction and a habit?
I really don't see the two as different, because a habit is something that we find meaning in engaging in, and I don't know what is too much or too little. There's no clear line that says now your behavior has, you've repeated it so much that it's become a habit, and now you're repeating it so much it's become an addiction. The two are really the same. Addiction originally, and the earliest use I could find was in the Bible in the 16th century, it meant devotion. The idea that addiction had anything to do with disease or uncontrollable behavior came about as a result of alcohol prohibition in the 1920s.
Mm-hmm.
But before that, people used the word addiction to mean devotion. And the root word is dicere, which means to say, to give consent. It shares the same root as abdication, dictator, dictation, all these words. It has, you know, it means that you want to do something. Now, I can't tell you what the difference between that is and a habit. Seems to me that they're the same. We may make judgments and say, if your habit is socially unacceptable, we're going to call that an addiction.
Mm.
And if it's socially acceptable, then we're going to say it's a habit.
Well, it's kind of like
artificial distinction.
Right, you know, it's like it's like drinking. If you look at drinking being acceptable, I mean, it gets celebratized in our world. You have ads for, alcohol, for beer, people at a baseball game with their beers in their hand, or you watch Mad Men, forget about it. Everybody's drinking, and that's how it was, because I worked that world at that same time.
Right.
There's a sexing up of alcohol and a demonization of marijuana going on at the same time.
That's right. And that is really an artificial distinction there. I mean, they're good drugs, they're bad drugs, but these are just inventions that people in power make.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I've read your book, but so a lot of these questions I'm asking you are, you know, I know the answer, but I know my listeners right. don't. So I don't want you to think, oh, what a silly question, Maria said she read the book.
No, what you're asking is very important.
You make it very clear, you know, you had a story in the book of a lady that came to you, and I actually repeated it somewhat to my friends this right. weekend. She came to you, she's in a miserable marriage, hates her job, hates her life. And when you suggest taking responsibility, changing your life, it seemed like that wasn't good enough, so she needed to go on Prozac. It's a right. very typical story for a lot of people. Well, I'm just going to take this drug for a little while until I feel better, but they don't change their life.
Exactly.
So don't you think that that's really showing a lack of courage to be dependent on a drug instead of depending on your own self and your will and your strength to do something about it?
I agree with you, Maria, yes. And what concerns me even more is that people start feeling good in a bad situation. In the story I talked about in the book, this woman needed to get a job, needed to leave her husband, needed to go back to school to change her life. She went for a regular physical. The doctor saw that she was very depressed, prescribed Prozac, and lo and behold, she felt better. Mm. Now, where is the motivation now to change her behavior?
There isn't, because she's like a zombie. They're zombied out when they're on those drugs.
Exactly. I mean, if we look back, everybody looks back on their life. Every important major change in their life was based on some experience of discomfort. Mm-hmm. That's not the same thing as going out and trying to create pain for yourself. But when you realize that you're really unhappy in a relationship, you've got to change your behavior somehow.
Right.
And taking a drug, whether it's cocaine or heroin or Prozac or Cymbalta or whatever, there really isn't any difference.
Right.
You're numbing out your feelings. One is socially acceptable because of who prescribes it.
Well, that's what I say. You know, when people have jobs and say they want to come home at night and they want to smoke a joint, well, they can't because they get drug tested. But they don't test for people being on Prozac, Wellbutrin, all these deadly medications that can make them want to commit murder on the job. Instead, they're worried about whether you're smoking a joint, which the only thing you're going to attack after that is the refrigerator.
Right.
Do you know what I mean?
Exactly.
So to me, when I see these signs, you know, I remember one day walking outside a Home Depot, and I was walking in with one of my friends, and they had a sign, now hiring, and we do drug tests. And I looked at that, and I said, you'd have to be on drugs to want to work a job like this.
Right.
You know, to me, that would be the only way I could deal with that kind of mundane day. But the hypocrisy is off the charts. It's like the government says, if you use the drugs we're making money on, you're not going to jail. But if you use the ones we haven't figured out how to make money on, you know, you're going to jail. You know what I'm saying? It's just ridiculous.
You've got it exactly right, Maria.
All right. But people tell me I'm crazy. You know, I don't know. To me, you don't need to be a rocket scientist to see the truth in all of this.
Right. I think much of it is common sense. That's what I tell my students. I also tell them, I mean, I've been a teacher in college for 22 years, and I say, don't believe anything I say. Think about these things.
Mm-hmm.
Think about the logic here and whether this makes sense. You come to your own conclusions on this.
Right.
And don't believe what somebody says just because he has an MD or a PhD.
Mm-hmm.
Think about what this means.
Right,
and,
well.
There's one thing that really flips people out, and I say to them, there's no such thing as a safe or dangerous, good or bad drug. It all depends on how you use the drug.
Mm-hmm.
You know, even some poisons in tiny amounts are used to keep as insecticides.
Mm-hmm.
There are all kinds of drugs that are used in varying poses. Look, if you want to commit suicide, you want to do it in the most painless, easiest way to do it. And
right.
in that sense, morphine would be considered a very good drug. Actually, in Canada, heroin is prescribed for terminal illness because it's more effective than morphine. In the United States, it's forbidden. Why? Because even if you have a terminal disease, you might get addicted to heroin.
Yeah, but you're dying. Listen, my sister, God rest her soul. My sister was 3 days from death in a hospital in Florida. She had a very rare disease called amyloidosis, where it's always fatal. And 3 days before, they wouldn't up her pain medication.
Right.
And I grabbed the doctor in the hall, and because he now, 3 days before she dies, wants to give her chemotherapy, which, of course, would be useless. And I said to him, why would you give her chemotherapy? You're going to tell me that's going to save her life? I said, I'm not Ben Casey, but I know she's dying,
Right.
And he says, well, it's all we have. I said, no, it isn't. I said, she needs more drugs. Give her painkillers. I says, the chance of her becoming a drug addict 3 days before she dies is pretty stupid if that's the reason why you're not giving it to her.
That's exactly right. There are all kinds of myths that come about with pain drugs.
Well, I got the drugs for her. Believe me, I got the drugs for her in like 5 minutes.
I was
like Shirley MacLaine in Terms of Endearment. So they probably wanted to drug my ass out while I was there.
No, I understand exactly what you mean. And, this crazy idea about narcotic drugs, which actually, when taken appropriately, are relatively safe.
Mm-hmm.
The only way people die is if they take too much.
Right.
But people can stay on methadone. And I'll tell you about something about myself. 12 years ago, I had major spine surgery, which it went wrong. The doctor took out too much bone, and I have been in horrible pain for the last 12 years. I mean, I told my wife and I told my daughter and even my doctor, I said, I may have to commit suicide on this. I cannot take this. This is too much. They put me on methadone, and the pain has been much, much better. I've been able to work and write. There's no high associated with it. And as I've changed my lifestyle in the last year, I've noticed that I have over 100 to 200 pills left over when I'm supposed to get my prescription refilled.
That's great.
I completely forget about getting more pills because it's something I don't think about.
Mm-hmm.
I realize, my God, my back is getting better. I have no desire to take the pills. And I'm not addicted to them in that sense. Now, you can, and any drug, produce some withdrawal symptoms, which can be uncomfortable.
Mm-hmm.
But the majority, especially if you've been on it for 12 years, daily. But most people who are in the hospital and are on morphine for a week or two, and then they don't need it anymore, they have no trouble giving up morphine.
Mm-hmm.
Talk to pain doctors.
Right.
They've told me this over and over again. It's just they've made this the boogeyman.
Right.
And unfortunately, in third world countries, it's even worse. They just let people commit suicide or just die writhing in pain on the ground. They will not let them have any kind of narcotic drug.
Look, my thoughts,
drugs.
My thoughts on Jack Kevorkian was he should have got the Nobel Prize.
Right.
Okay. Right. Because if you look at quality of life, and that matters. And no one, medicine, unfortunately, is keeping people alive too long, longer than they want to be alive. You're just a shell of a person, or you're sitting there with Alzheimer's. That's not a future that I would want for myself or anybody I love.
You're so right, Maria. You are so right.
Now, when you say you change
quality, quantity versus quality.
Exactly. My lifestyle is very active. I go to the gym 6 days a week. I eat an organic vegan diet. I'm not on any medications. I'm 64 years old. I have the strength and the body of a 30-year-old. I'm happy. I keep my mind busy. I'm engaged in what I do. All these things are important. The human body doesn't really need much more. So I'm curious, how did you change your lifestyle? What changed?
I started walking and went a little bit farther each day.
Mm-hmm.
I changed the distance that I had to drive to school 5 days a week. And what else? And I lost weight, and I spent time writing, which I had stopped doing.
Mm-hmm.
Although writing can be tricky because you end up sitting too long.
Right.
But going outside, walking, walking my dog, not driving as much as I used to. I have to be careful because my spine is so fragile that mm-hmm. they don't even want me to do yoga because they're afraid something's going to break down again.
Well, yoga is just good stretching, you know.
It is.
But you took responsibility.
I did martial arts. I did endurance sporting events, all of that stuff. But I decided, too, that I didn't have to push myself to the limit, that I could say, this is good enough, and would give myself a break, and that's what helped me more than anything.
Well, that's great. You took responsibility. You didn't just depend on the medical community.
Exactly. And I have a wonderful relationship with my doctor, but I don't depend on him other than when I need to get a medication, he gives me the medication, and he trusts
me. Well, I can tell you, I have a friend who is my age, and she was on about 6 different pain pills. She had the same kind of severe back surgeries and pain constantly. Right. She couldn't even climb 2 steps. And I had suggested to her, instead of all those drugs and even a pain patch, which I didn't even know, all this stuff, she was like, she acted like she was a zombie most of the time.
Right.
Because medical marijuana became legal in Arizona, I suggested she check it out. And she was blown away by it. Her doctor recommended it. And she's pretty much pain-free.
Well, that's good to hear.
So that's something, you know, everybody should check out, okay? Because like I always say, if it's a plant, use it. If it comes from a plant, don't use it. We only have 2 minutes left, but I did want to cover. I think the solution, if we want to use the word solution, that I got out of your book, to not be an addict, okay, is whatever problems you're having in life need to be addressed.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. That's the point of the whole book. Don't look at the drug. Look at how you live your life and what you don't want to look at. It's the introspection, and you've got to honestly search your heart and your own lifestyle and take responsibility for it. That's going to be the best therapy than anything. I mean, when people come to me for help with drugs and alcohol, I don't focus on their drug and alcohol use. I focus on how they're living their life. And then 6 months later, I say, how's the drinking and drug use? And they said, I don't even do it anymore. I've been focused on these other issues, changing my life.
That's great. Well, I want to give out your website. It's Shaler, Schaler.net. Of course, it's right here. It's highlighted. Just click through and check out his work, because I really think he's going to give you a whole different perspective on what you've been thinking about psychology, addiction, so many different things. Jeffrey, I want to thank you so much, and keep me on your list when your new book comes out.
I certainly will. Thank you so much, Maria. You're a terrific host.
Oh, thanks so much. Take care.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye. Jeffrey Shaler, pretty damn good. Anyway, tomorrow I'll be back with the Blasted News. That's Maria.net, Meria.net. And I hope you learned something today, and I hope that you feel better about yourself or whatever issues you're going through. Don't let them label you. I'll see you guys tomorrow.
Thank you for listening and supporting the Maria Show. Tell others what you learned today. Knowledge becomes wisdom only when it's shared. Encourage others to subscribe today. www.maria.net. Often imitated, never duplicated. A world of information all in one place. www.maria.net. Always ahead of the curve. Always on your side. Get active or get radioactive. Subscribe today.